The sky was cloudless. The sea was flat, calm. The only wind was that created by the ship's movement. At approximately 7 o'clock, the Hesslers sat down at their table in the dining room for their evening meal. Happy anniversary! They had just been served their soup and salad when suddenly Emma Hessler found herself sitting on the deck, covered with her food. Trays of food were flying across the room. Chairs. Now try to put yourself into this scene. It's a calm day. Chairs, tables, food, and people were sliding across the dining floor. The ship had suddenly listed 45 degrees to the port. Then slowly, very slowly, on Tuesday, January 28, 1975, the Star of Peace set sail for San Salvador in the Bahamas for several weeks of cruising and diving. Some of McCulloch's business associates were to meet the vessel there. You know old McCulloch. It was good sailing weather on January 30th as the Star of Peace reached along under full sail. The rays of the subtropical winter sun appeared to be dancing on top of the waves. The air was warm. Most of the crew were lazily sitting or standing around the deck. The wind in the rigging, the sound of the sea, and the schooner's heeling hull plunged through the waves. And that was all that broke the silence of the ocean. I'm reading from Devil's Triangle 2 in case you got lost. The only machinery running was below decks, where a small air compressor was being used to fill scuba diving tanks. The vessel was under the command of Dan Smith, an executive in McCulloch's firm. Others aboard included John Messer and John and Jack Sion, both of Fort Lauderdale, Randy Seath of Merritt Island, Florida, and Jerry Baldiga of Dudley, Massachusetts. I want you to remember all these fellows. Early in the afternoon, Smith went below to check the compressor. The tank, scuba diving tank, being filled, registered only 1,500 pounds. A tank full holds 2,200 pounds of air pressure. Another 10 to 15 minutes of filling would do it. Now, the safety tolerance of the tank was over 3,000 pounds. Smith headed topside. Just as he reached the deck, now you remember those fellows. It was daylight. The sun had not yet lifted above the horizon. The weather was clear and balmy as the motor vessel Atlantic City plied westward less than a day away from her destination, Newport News, Virginia. Morris of South Wales was on lookout duty atop the Atlantic City's bridge. Most of the crew were still sleeping. Soon it'd be time to awaken them, ready the ship for entering port. So Morris was joined by the officer of the watch, who chatted for a few minutes before returning below to the wheelhouse. Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging, and circling erratically. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great ball of fire, traveling rapidly and heading directly for the ship. It was on a collision course with the Atlantic City. Panicking, Morris began to jump over the wind dodger to the foredeck below. Put yourself in these scenes. The mate grabbed him and pulled him back to the deck. The two terrified men lay there, covering their faces. That guy didn't pull him back because he was friendly. He just didn't want to be left alone. Hearing no noise whatsoever, they looked up. The fireball was nearly upon them. Its glare made them squint, making no roar or noise whatsoever. It passed directly over the ship, clearing the mastheads by what seemed like only inches. The men leaped to their feet, but now we got the honeymooners, no, the anniversary mooners, on the floor. We got the ship at 45 degrees listing. We got something going on below deck on the Star of Peace. And we got great balls of fire terrifying the Atlantic City ship. What I said. Now, don't you think that these folks that stay up late need to have the whole frame of reference before we start concluding these stories that you've been made tense with? You couldn't sleep now anyway. You might as well just settle down. In October 1954, the Coast Guard buoy tender Smilax was proceeding north from Brunswick, Georgia, to various points along the South Carolina coast. Coast Guard buoy tender, this is. This government ship. As the 100-foot-long Smilax crossed Ossabaw Sound near Savannah, she ran into a very dense fog. Seaman Second Class Ike Levine, now Master Chief Boatswain's Mate, mate at the Fort Lauderdale Coast Guard Station, took over the bow watch just before midnight, once each minute. The vessel's foghorn bellowed out. I think I can tell you that one. I can hurry up along that one. In the fog, foghorns approached and passed, and when they put a searchlight out, a light shined down on their searchlight, and they couldn't find anything. I'll skip that one. It's not as exciting as the next one. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Yamacraw, former World War II mine layer converted by the Coast Guard to combination cable laying and research ship. She had a white superstructure and a black hull. Remember that one? Large letters on her hull disclosed her designation. WARC 333. The name Yamacraw from an Indian tribe. Commanded by William D. Strouch. August 8, 1956, the Yamacraw was on a heading of 165 degrees. Her position was 30 degrees 65 north, 73.80 west, which placed her in what is sometimes referred to as the Sargasso or Seaweed Sea. It was 01:30 hours when the radar operator called out, "Large landmass dead ahead." range 28 miles. Now, remember that Greek industrialist? He went on a diving expedition, found about 150 fathoms down, a 600-foot high pyramid structure with an opening that was sucking things in, and down another opening, things coming out. Dr. Brown was diving, looked back toward the sun, saw a mirror-shaped pyramid almost near the surface, saw an opening and went in, saw a crystal in a set of metallic hands, grabbed the crystal and swam like hell. Still has the crystal. Mayor candidate for Orlando, Florida, flying at low level to explore the bottom. Suddenly there was turbulence in the water. A trough appeared in the water. He saw a pyramid-like structure rise up, just part of it out of the water, like a periscope of a submarine cutting the water on each side. The turbulence made the waves rise on each side of the wings. Water spout updraft hit him and threw him up 1,000 feet. Now we've sat in the sea pyramids in the Bermuda Triangle area that rise out of the water, under the water. The one in Egypt is about between 400 and 500 feet tall. That one they saw, 650 feet tall. The sonar measurements on the Azores Plateau reveal a pyramid about that size. Landsat 2, taking photographs from 500 miles up, 8 dots and parallel lines, 4 on each side, low-lying airplanes in the Amazon jungle of Peru, checking out the dots, find there are 12 instead of 8, and they're giant pyramid structures, almost the height of the ones in Egypt, not yet explored. All of this is what we've been looking at, right? Now, all these strange happenings, including the poor anniversary mooners, great balls of fire, passing foghorns and strange lights in the fog. And it is recorded, they've tried to explain it through history, that just before Columbus sighted land, there was a strange glow he saw in the sky above the water. They tried to explain it as Indians burning some fires in their canoes offshore. You've got to be awful dumb to build a fire in your canoe out in the ocean. And you know about the fleet of ships associated with Columbus that took the 150-pound solid gold table, and all of them lost. You don't know that story? There's a 150-pound gold table down there somewhere. Now, Yamacraw. It was 0130 hours when the radar... All of this is... I didn't finish any of these stories, did I? I'm going to tell you something. If you don't fill the King's House on Sunday, it's going to get worse. If you know somebody that isn't coming, you better call them. I'm getting angry. You can get here Sunday if you leave from New York now. Fast walk will get you here from Reno. It was 0130 hours when the radar operator called out large landmass dead ahead, range 28 miles. Impossible, responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. There's only one landmass on our heading, and that's the Dominican Republic over 800 miles away. The radar operator adjusted and readjusted his equipment. Again, he called the officer of the watch. Ensign Flynn, the radar is showing a landmass directly ahead on our course. Take a look for yourself. Flynn studied the radar screen. You're right. It's got to be a landmass. Look how straight it is, almost as if it were drawn by a pencil. Wake up the skipper. I'm going to check the compasses and take another position fix. Do you know this guy, Richard Weiner, lived in Florida most of his life? Amazing how you can grow up around things and never pay any attention. He lived in Florida most of his life. But his introduction to his book about the Devil's Triangle says, just across the harbor from Hong Kong and Kowloon, there was a flagrant waterfront establishment known as Mike's Bar. His clientele consisted, Mike was a full-blooded Chinaman. His clientele consisted of sailors, members of the Crown Colony's underworld, waterfront bums, prostitutes, characters in general, even occasional lost or misguided tourists. The saloon's claim to fame was that it was the roughest bar in the world. Even the notorious Quinn's Bar in Tahiti couldn't rival Mike's place. I've seen them both, by the way. When Mike's patrons were not actively engaged in a brawl, they were probably watching one. It was here in 1967 that I first heard of a small, mysterious section of the sea halfway around the world called the Devil's Triangle. He grew up in Florida, having lived in Florida, rather, for over 15 years. He was in Hong Kong before he got the story that finally turned him on. There are people who lived and died in America, know nothing about these strange happenings. And the establishment, you know. I started this whole series, remember, saying, science builds upon a faith premise. Things are always the same and explainable by the same natural processes. And they've proceeded at basically the same rate in the same way. Mountains rise, become sedimentary plains, same rate. Velikovsky was at war with the community for years because he postulated cataclysms. You can't be a Christian, Hebrew Christian, either one of the two, Hebraic or Christian, and not accept the cataclysms have shook this earth and it's too cold in here. Turn the cooler down a little bit. Now, the establishment doesn't want anybody to think anything is out of normal. I haven't yet taught on shamanism. I remember seeing a TV program on, I'd like to find it. I wish all my engineers and every person who listens to me could find a copy of it. I only saw it once. And if I could find it and buy the rights, I'd play it on our university network. It was a filmed experience of shamanism in an interior jungle where this witch doctor shaman, in that case, not all of them are witch doctors, would, and shamanism basically believes you have an animal counterpart that's with you at all times. In an experience much like the opposite of exorcism, when you cast a demon out of someone, the shaman transformed a series of men that he was working on into their animal counterpart. And in the key case, they became a wild hog, one of them, that eats roots that are poisonous to the human if they eat them. The digestive tract of the wild hog could digest the poisonous roots. In their state, produced and brought on by the shaman, they would eat the wild roots with no ill effect. It was a very delicate performance as he would then release them from their animal counterpart and restore them to normalcy. And he had to carefully clean all fragments and pieces of the root out of their mouth because they'd been rooting with their mouth and eating the wild poisonous root. And he had to carefully clean all of it out of their mouth before he restored them to their normal state. Because if it was still in their mouth and they ate it or swallowed it, when they came out of the, to make a word up, shamanized state, it would poison them. Other animals that ate fish would dive right into the water when they were shamanized. I'm using a word I'm making up. Into their counterpart, they would, like animals, grab the fish out of the pond and eat them. They duplicated their animal counterparts' behavior. The most amazing being, the capacity to take on those poisonous roots. There are people that grow up in a simple little myopic, insulated society, know nothing about the reality of miracles. That's why, you know, I am so sick of some of this shoddy stuff that goes on and makes God kind of a second-rate performer. I have watched the witch doctors among head-hunting tribes in northern Luzon perform things that there was no explanation for. I've seen things in the interior of India and Africa, and at the Spirit of Services in Brazil and Haiti. Now, I have an explanation. The Bible gives one. And particularly that that involves demon power. But I remember some of my professors who had grown up in an isolated community, gone to school and got good grades, and became a professor's assistant and got their own doctorate and began to teach. To them, this was all fairy tale. I'd love to snatch some of those prima donnas and put them in a head-hunting village 100 miles north of Baguio in the northern Luzon Mountains of the Philippines. Or take them to the real Spirit of Service in Brazil, when the old gal lays her hands on their head and they begin to jerk. And you're sitting one seat behind them. And the first thing the old gal has to do is keep them from killing themselves as they go into various contortions. Shamanism is a subject I'm so frustrated that I can't get any of the subjects. I'm deliberately doing some dangling with you now. Dang it, you've been frustrating me. But there are subjects that we need to deal with that I can't get on, because the best words I can use will not make the people that ought to prove the ideal that we stand for perform. On July 7th, 1819, the wooden A-frame lifting device was again erected, and the heavy marble block, 1,000-pound, readied for removal from the entrance. It's amazing the way your expressions changed when the pizza came up. The heavy marble block readied for removal from the entrance of the infamous depository for the dead. You know, we pay almost $13,000 a week for these 4 hours every night. We ought to stay up one night a week and talk to the people that are here, don't you think? Of course, some of you might think it could have been another night. I don't want to see any of you here tomorrow night unless you take a nap during the day. Or unless you have the faith to believe God can give you strength. Any of you ever remember, you know, lots of people think the way I preach, I don't believe in this. Any of you remember the old days when revivals would happen and you could suddenly get by on 2 and 3 hours sleep a night? Anybody here remember any of that? And of course, some people have been in one. on July 7th, 1819. Now, I've got to prolong this until the pizza gets here, don't I? The wooden A-frame lifting device was again erected, and a heavy marble block readied for removal from the entrance of the infamous depository for the dead. Government officials carefully examined the cement that had been applied to the joint between the marble slab and the doorway to the vault. The onlookers crowded around the site were disappointed when informed that the entranceway was undisturbed. Not going to be any excitement this time. Nobody got in. But their disappointment was not to last for long. The blacks heaved on the block and tackle, but the big marble slab wouldn't budge. It was as if some force on the inside was causing the block to resist movement. The stonemasons double-checked to be sure that they'd removed all of the cement. You say, why are you smoking that pipe? Well, they're about... That's what you said. You know, there are about seven reasons why I'm smoking it. One of them is... Well, I'll save that. It was as if some force on the inside was causing the block to resist movement. The stonemasons double-checked to be sure they'd removed all the cement, sat down and lit their pipes. Finally, with the help of wooden wedges driven by sledgehammers. One of the reasons I'm smoking it. I like it. Now, there are six more reasons. You say, why are you smoking it? Give me the other six reasons. The second reason is, I like to make my evangelist critics mad. I maybe ought to move that up to number one. Now, there's five more reasons. The third reason is, I like to make my evangelist critics mad. Now, there are four more reasons. The fourth reason is, the stonemasons double-checked, I'll say that. Stonemasons double-checked to be sure they'd removed all of the cement. You know, this is made out of a root. And it's a mishum on it. The fourth reason is, you're not interested. I like to make my evangelist critics mad. There's three more reasons. The fifth reason, but I'll save that. Stonemasons double-checked to be sure that they'd removed all of the cement. Finally, with the help of wooden wedges driven by sledgehammers, the block began to move up. But there's only one way to go. The 1,000 pounds. The onlookers crouching to get a better look then saw what had impaired the attempt to clear the entryway. The fifth reason is, I like to make my television evangelist critics mad. Now, there are two more reasons. The onlookers, crouching to get a better look, then saw what had impaired the attempt to clear the stairway, entryway. The sixth reason is, now I wasn't going to tell you, but you seem to want that. I like to make my television evangelist critics of me mad. There's one more reason. The onlookers, crouching to get a better look, then saw what had happened, or had impaired the attempt to clear the entryway. The you're not going to determine what I do. I ain't going to tell you the seventh reason till I get ready to. The onlookers, crouching to get a better look, then saw this wicked lover crepting. The onlookers, crouching to get a better look, you don't really care now, do you? The onlookers, crouching to get a better look, then saw what had impaired the attempt to clear the entryway. The seventh reason. I like to make my evangelist critics mad. Prove how little religion they really have. Let's get on to business now. The onlookers, crouching to get a better look, then saw what had impaired the attempt to clear the entryway. Let's make it mysterious now. The casket of Thomas Chase, the lead one, that took 8 men to move. The casket of Thomas Chase had been wedged against the door. Every coffin in the tomb was strewn about the dismal interior of the crypt, with the exception of Mrs. Goddard's. Bless her soul. With the exception of Mrs. Goddard's, which was still standing, bound in ropes where it had been left 3 years before. I hope stringing this out has not made you lose the frame of reference. It's pretty weird. This was through several years. With the exception of Mrs. Goddard's, which was still standing, bound in ropes where it had been left 3 years before, the ones containing the children, which had been set on top of the others, were on the floor. Again, all of the coffins were removed and the vault was scrutinized inch by inch. And once more, the examiners found nothing to indicate that entry could have been gained by any means other than the front door. So well built was the structure that not even the smallest crack could be found. The tomb apparently was airtight, for not even an insect was seen. There was no trace of moisture or water having seeped into the tomb. And as was noted during the previous inspection, the coffin showed no sign of an attempt to force them open. Governor Combermere who was a veteran of the King's Cavalry, decided the next sealing of the vault would be handled scientifically. He ordered that a layer of fine white sand be spread evenly over the entire floor of the tomb. The caskets were reinterred along with Mrs. Clark's. Everything from the depth of the sand to the exact position of each coffin was recorded. That Mrs. Clark's, the new one, went in. The blue marble block was replaced, 1,000 pounds, and wet cement was again applied around the joint between the block and the tomb. Have you ever heard about this before? Before the cement could dry, a number of officials pressed their personal marks and seals into it. Opening the vault would be impossible without destroying those seal impressions. A member of the constabulary was assigned the task of daily checking the vault and its sealed door. Daily. The Chase Vault had become one of the biggest tourist attractions in the West Indies. Usually the first question asked by those stepping ashore in Barbados was, how do I get to the Chase Vault? I want them to do that in Los Angeles. How do I get to King's House 1? For different reasons. For months to come, wherever people gathered, in taverns, at church, with social affairs, conversation invariably turned to what would be found the next time the Chase Vault was opened. But no one died. Finally, the officialdom of Barbados succumbed to impatience. The House of the Living Dead was ordered reopened. On April 20th, 1820, Governor Cumbermere, some of his staff, Reverend Orderson, and two stonemasons converged on the Christ Church crypt. An intense investigation disclosed that there had been no attempt to open the vault. The impressions in the cement seal around the door were undisturbed. The governor ordered the masons to begin chipping away at the seal as the blacks again erected their hoisting rig. As the huge block was being raised, kneeling and crouching men strained their eyes to peer into the dismal interior. They saw. As the huge block was slowly being raised, kneeling and crouching men strained their eyes to peer into the dismal interior. They saw. Shall I quit? Why not? They saw. Because is not an answer. They saw exactly what they expected. Chaos. In order to enter, the men had to climb over the children's casket laying at the top of the stairs. All the coffins, with the exception of Mrs. Goddard's, seems to have been flung about. The white sand on the floor was undisturbed. No attempt had been made to open the caskets. One of the governor's party, Nathan Lucas, gave the following account later. I examined the walls, the arches, and every part of the vault, and I found every part old and similar. And a mason in my presence struck every part of the bottom with his hammer, and all was solid. Even the areas outside the crypt were examined. Iron rods were driven down to the bedrock in search of tunnels. Not one clue was found. No one could come up with an answer as to what had so chaotically strewn the coffins about. Extremely dismayed, Governor Cumbermere ordered that the casket be removed from the Chase Vault and reinterred elsewhere. The crypt was left open and has never again been used as a depository for corpses. John Goodwin, in his book, This Baffling World, examines the Chase Vault mystery in some detail. His book includes reproductions of several official documents on the subject, but he, like everyone else, could offer no answer. Whatever created so much havoc in the tomb at Christ Church, obviously, was not a natural force. Of course, many of the happenings in the Devil's Triangle might not be the result of natural forces. I mean, doesn't that blow you away? Doesn't that blow you away? I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that some strange things go on in and about the devil's triangle. Right? Now, on their 55th anniversary, they're on the deck. They're about to land in port, and they're on the deck with the fireball and that other thing, Star of Peace, or whatever the heck it was called. Yamacraw's in the Mass, and it ain't a Catholic Mass. What about this triangle? Shall I continue? Well, we will. I'm going to stay with this subject.